highly developed and very interesting, and some other countries as well, and see models that are in the process of being experimented with, and you know, come up with our own kind of community model. And we just have to break from what we have now, and then really go through the process of defining and encouraging new systems.
That was Paul Rowland speaking with Jerry Mander, author of several books, including In the Absence of the Sacred, and most recently, The Capitalism Papers, Fatal Flaws of an Obsolete System. He'll be speaking at the Economics of Happiness Conference coming next week, February 27th to March 1st, at the Elliott Center in downtown Portland. More information about the conference is available at our website, kboo.fm, on the right-hand side of the homepage, under Community Events, or at www.localfutures.org. This is KBOO Portland. It's 11:30 a.m., and coming up, we hear the organizers of next week's panel discussion on occupation, environmental destruction, and the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not currently a KBOO member, you can remedy that at kboo.fm. Click where it says Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Becoming Dr. Ruth, produced by Triangle Theater. Starting February 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Becoming Dr. Ruth tells the story of the outrageous and iconic Dr. Ruth Westheimer and the journey she took from fleeing the Nazis to her struggle as a single mother to coming to America and becoming a renowned sex therapist. Again, that's Becoming Dr. Ruth, produced by Triangle Productions, from February 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Ask me how it is that I dare to take a side. You say I loathe myself, pointing out you have lied. You say it's tribal warfare, but I disagree, for the dynamics of the situation are not difficult to see. On the one side is the fighter jet, on the other is the stone. On the one side is the slave, on the other is the throne. For the many there are checkpoints, while foreign soldiers rule the streets. For the one side there is victory, but the people don't accept defeat. The word you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the tanks return to Tel Aviv. On the one side there is hunger and bulldozed olive trees. On the other is the army, ruling by decrees. Caterpillars maul the streets, destroy whole city blocks, while children swallow shrapnel for the crime of throwing rocks. Fences are erected around the towns they flatten, and Herzl's own fanatics sleep on sheets of satin. And they water their plantations, drilling ever deeper wells, while the displaced children of the hopeless are filled with bullet shells. The word you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the settlers return to Tel Aviv.
The great David Rovics, a song, Occupation. My name is Jenka Soderberg. I am live in the studio with Sarah Swetsoff with Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights here at Portland State University. The sponsors, along with numerous co-sponsors of an event this coming week on Tuesday, February 24th at 6:30, that is entitled Occupation, Environmental Destruction, and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, a panel discussion on international resistance. The panel actually features a Palestinian speaker as well as several Native American speakers and a speaker with Jewish Voice for Peace. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us this morning on KBOO.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jenka.
And we will also be joined by Cecily Saraski, the Deputy Director of Jewish Voice for Peace. Cecily, are you with us?
Yes, I am, and happy to be here.
Great. And a little bit later, we'll be speaking with Kanahus Manuel, who is a warrior activist from Canada who's been resisting pipelines and mining and will be a part of this panel this coming Tuesday. Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about the panel to begin with? I understand the attempt is to make connections between U.S. imperialism and colonialism abroad and the settler colonialism that this country was founded on, right?
Exactly, Jenka. We consider the U.S. imperialism abroad, the wars abroad in Iraq, in the Middle East, military support for Israel, and the stake of the U.S. in the Middle East to be a direct continuation of its colonial heritage and ongoing colonialism here in North America, so-called North America, known by many as Turtle Island, belonging to many indigenous nations who are still struggling to assert their sovereignty and actively losing land and struggling against pipelines and mining and other forms of colonialism and extraction capitalism.
And Cecily, you are the Deputy Director of Jewish Voice for Peace, and you've also been a video maker, a newspaper columnist, talk radio host. Your most recent piece, an electronic intifada, was called Speaking Out About Israel to Save the Jewish Soul. How do you think that American history and what we're seeing right now in Israel-Palestine is connected?
Oh, they're remarkably connected. You know, we talk very frequently, our leaders talk about the special relationship between Israel and the United States, or there is little sunlight between us. And that's absolutely true. And really, we would suggest that it is, in many ways, that special friendship is rooted in similar narratives of two peoples with a divine mandate or a perceived divine mandate to settle a savage land and make it into a kind of heaven on earth. That manifest destiny narrative that we are so familiar with in this country is very similar to the notion of the chosen people in Israel. And in fact, those relationships aren't subtle at all. Early Zionist leaders, in a sense, were both victims of European colonialism and willing agents of it. And if you look at the language that many of them used to make the case for creating the State of Israel and appealing to colonial powers, it sounds remarkably similar to the language that is used to describe savages, quote-unquote, the language used to describe indigenous people in this country.
And now we have this ongoing issue with the expansion of the State of Israel. And in the original creation in 1948 of Israel under a UN recommendation, there was a call or a cry out from Zionists at that time saying that this was a land without a people for a people without land. And that seems somewhat similar to what the European colonists were talking about in the U.S. What's your thought on that particular claim?
I would say that is the essential. You have gotten to the crux of the issue. If you want to understand the roots of what we are still struggling over today, it is precisely that claim, which was not true. There was an indigenous population there, of course, as we now know, but many people were led to believe or wanted, literally could not see what was in front of their eyes, that there was a people there who had lived there. Many families had lived there for hundreds, if not years longer, who did, in fact, develop the land. There were cities that had movie theaters and poetry, and there was all kinds of things going on in this world that we literally, because we were primed through, I believe, our own narrative here in this country, we were literally primed and unable to see the people there. So if you talk about occupation, you talk about Israel's ongoing land grab, the destruction of Palestinian lives and ethnic cleansing, it all goes back to the fact that, in fact, people were there, and so in order to create an ethnic exclusivist state, a Jewish state, what are you going to do with the people who actually are there? and who are not part of your vision. And that's where what we have to this day is really an extended, ongoing process of ethnic cleansing, a continual effort through a variety of means to remove indigenous Palestinians from that area.
Wow. And Sarah, you helped organize this panel. How did you decide to make these connections?
Well, I'm thinking about the last Students for Justice in Palestine National Conference, and it seemed that almost every speaker in every event, we would open by acknowledging the indigenous land that we were on. This year, we happened to be in Massachusetts. And I saw that as a change even from last year's conference. So this type of awareness and consciousness of our own position as settlers in a settler colonial nation is, I think, permeating all of our activist discourse, and essentially so, because, you know, we can't address problems abroad without acknowledging what's going on here at home. So I think this is a natural, kind of a natural outgrowth of the conversations that we've been having amongst ourselves as organizers, and also part of our, you know, our location in the so-called Pacific Northwest, looking around us, seeing the, for example, the activism against the megaloads transports last winter. Well, that was the Umatilla Nation working with environmental groups like Rising Tide to prevent the transport of heavy equipment to Alberta for the tar sands. And it happens that a former CEO of the company transporting that equipment is on the foundation of Portland State. We've got a building named after him. So we saw just how deeply complicit our university is in the dispossession of indigenous peoples in our immediate region. And noticing that, we couldn't help but make that connection to what's going on in Palestine and want to address that more directly.
Mm. So the environmental destruction piece I wanted to get into a little bit, you know, at Portland State University, as you mentioned, there is a fossil fuel divestment campaign. Do you, Sarah, as a student there, a student activist, actually connect with the divestment from fossil fuels and the divestment campaign to divest from companies involved in the Israeli occupation?
Oh, definitely. I think they have a lot of shared stakes in global capitalism, and particularly extraction capitalism. For example, like G4S is a company that's best known for private prisons and armored transport vehicles, private prisons in Israel and armored transport vehicles to transport detainees on the U.S.-Mexico border. Well, the last time I went to a coal transport protest here in Portland, G4S was the company providing the security outfit. So they've got, you know, a stake in every form of destructive capitalism, and then the incarceration and border policing that has to be maintained in order for those businesses to continue to thrive.
For people who aren't aware of G4S, what's their role in the Israeli occupation?
Their role is running private prisons and detention centers that target both Palestinians and African refugees. That's about what I know.
And I understand there are a lot of youth and children in those prisons as well.
There are. Recently a college student of just, I think, 17 years old was arrested last month. I think a 15-year-old young person was arrested and held for a number of weeks. I know from
9-year-olds.
Cecily, you want to just weigh in on the prison, the prisoners in that are being held by Israel? I know it's one of those issues that doesn't get talked about as much as some of the other parts.
Yeah, I mean, as Sarah was saying, there's an absolute problem with holding of children, actually, routinely bringing children in as young as 9 years old to prisons. It's really quite shocking. But I also want to underscore the importance of these linkages that are being made. As Sarah talked about it, what we find in this movement so often is for those who've been very involved in Israel-Palestine politics, an understanding, for example, of what it meant that the creation of Israel meant the disappearance of the deliberate erasure of some 400 Palestinian villages. And for so long, chances are when we were decrying that erasure, we were probably standing on land here in this continent on which the identical thing happened, but we are actually participating in that erasure here. So I think it's absolutely critical to understand this whole issue both as a mirror to the process of settler colonialism here, but also if we really want to get to the roots. In other words, if you decontextualize this, there are those who think, you know, the real problem is the Israel lobby, and the United States would have a perfectly just and reasonable foreign policy when it comes to the Middle East if it were not for that all-powerful Israel lobby. If that is the road you go down, I believe very strongly you're actually going to be unable to get to the real roots, and looking through a frame of colonialism and corporate profit at this point, and U.S. as the sole remaining superpower, and how this is in our interest is actually the only way you're going to really be able to intervene effectively.
Mm. Well, and you bring up an important point, I think, of the hypocrisy of standing on stolen land and then calling out these settler colonial issues in other parts of the world. How is it that that we as people in the United States, people who are living on this stolen land, can break through that settler colonial mentality that sets up these roadblocks to actually address the inherent racism within our system?
That is the million-dollar question, and I think understanding all the ways that we are implicated in it, and I'll give you a specific example, how we really need to decolonize our own minds and how crucial that is. You know, the struggle against any kind of hatred is an incredibly important struggle. In my community, the struggle against anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish hatred, it's a very real part of the historical landscape. It's a profound part of our experience. And that struggle has been absolutely appropriated by a sort of colonial agenda that ideologically justifies our wars in Arab countries through the demonization of Muslims and Arabs. In fact, historical anti-Semitism absolutely is a feature of Christian Europe, not traditionally the Arab world and the Muslim world, although that has changed recently. And so, but that struggle has been absolutely appropriated, and we end up inadvertently participating. There's a very deliberate manipulation of that work to feed and fuel the demonization of Muslims, which we at Jewish Voice for Peace feel very strongly that we must stand up against and counter and engage in our own decolonization of our own community. And our own fears, again, are used, and we are re-traumatized in a way to, again, delegitimize the hopes and dreams and the just demands of Palestinians. And so I can just tell you, in our community, it is incredibly hard work to do that decolonization, understanding, and those of us who are white, those of us of European descent, et cetera. And as you can imagine, it's not always easy to do that in our own community. And we have, many of us started as sole voices, quite isolated, and people were kicked out of their communities and yelled at. And now things have changed. So I do believe that organizing and developing these networks with each other, we are seeing and the work that's happening on campuses in particular to really, and Sarah can speak to that, to really shift that dynamic so we are conscious in a way that we have not ever been before.
And so, Sarah, if you want to address that briefly, and then we're going to also bring in Kanahus into this conversation.
To segue into that, well, the divestment movements on campus is a great tool for educating people and turning their attention to that complicity of the university, the different companies and products that we might interact with on a daily basis that profit from the dispossession of indigenous peoples both here and abroad. And that's a good starting point, but I think we need to take that education a step further and also be physically present as allies in supporting indigenous peoples. And I know everyone who has the chance to visit Palestine in person and be on the front lines of those protests and see what it looks like in Area C with villagers being kicked off their land, that's a powerful experience, and you can't ever be the same after seeing that. And we can do the same thing here. The there's blockades in Sepwapmuk territory of Kanahos's nation. There's blockades of Unistaten territory that are also trying to prevent the Northern Gateway pipeline from passing through their land. That's all within something like a 6 or 10 hour drive of us, and they need our help. And there's an open call for people to represent at those encampments and help Indigenous peoples physically defend their land.
Well, and we do now have Kanahos on the phone. She's a mother and a warrior from the Sequapmet Nation in the Shuswap region of so-called British Columbia, and has been active in fighting against development projects and corporations such as the Sun Peak Ski Resort, Imperial Metals, and more recently involved in the fight against the pipelines, and as well as mining on Indigenous lands. She and her children are featured in a movie called Freedom Children. Kanahos, welcome to KBOO.
Hello.
And we have been talking about decolonization of the mind and trying to bring together the issues where the Native people in the U.S. Are fighting colonization, have been for hundreds of years, and this ongoing colonization that's going on in Palestine. How do you see these as connected?
We are the same. Like, there's no differentiating between this. Like, we have a state that's oppressing Indigenous people, you know, taking land, forcing people to be a landless people without a homeland. And this impacts us not only physically, because we're no longer have our homelands free like we were able to roam before, but it's also impacting us like in our social structure. It's impacting our environment. It's impacting the whole way that we live and the culture that we are meant to continue on living, that it's totally land-based. Our culture is totally land-based. But I heard you talking about, you know, the destruction of homes and going into those villages. It's exactly the untold story of what happens here in our homelands as well. Whenever we go out into our homelands to assert our jurisdiction on our homelands, we get our homes bulldozed down and destroyed. And this is both the Canadian government and the companies that do this in concert with each other. And they do this with each other, and they collaborate on how they're going to be able to take more land, get more consent for land, show people that there's no risk on their investing in BC, because they rid themselves of the natives through injunction and enforcement orders and through trespass notices and through stuff like that are forcing our people, like literally forcing our people by gunpoint and police, to get off our land or else, you know, face jail time. And, you know, like one lucky thing about being in Canada is that as Native organizers, we have, you know, there's very little that they can do to us for speaking out. Like, they could throw us in jail, but it's not like our other relatives and our comrades in other parts of the country or the other countries in Mexico, Central America, that are being murdered and really being thrown in jail for long, long, long periods of time. But I feel that we're not far from it, you know, with these new laws coming into place where they're looking at Native people as domestic terrorists. I think that we're not far from this, but we need people to know, and we need the eyes to be watching and looking at Canada, because Canada is right there, right across the border, and all of our water is connected, all the salmon is connected, you know, so the water doesn't know no borders, the salmon don't know no borders, and you know, our moose and our deer, and so these are everything that impacts our land is impacting us as human beings. They're, with these mining companies coming in, that's their new form of warfare. You look at the Mount Polley disaster, and it looks like one of the most war-torn places in the world, and it's a mining company that did it. So this is their new way that they're waging war on our people, because you decimate a salmon stock, you're really killing off our people.
And Ekanahus, we only have a few minutes left, but I want to hear just briefly from you about Freedom Children. How do you raise children to be decolonized in this type of warfare that's going on against Native peoples?
It's called Freedom Babies, actually. But, it took me to really make that stand. I ended up going to jail for 3 months and taken away from my newborn baby, who was 3 months old at the time, till he was 7 months. But those 3 months isn't that long, but when you're in jail and you know it's because you're fighting for your land, I had a lot to think about. And one thing I already knew was that I wasn't going to register my kids with the state. I wasn't going to register them with the province in order for them to get a birth certificate or a social insurance number or to say that they exist as status Indians here in Canada. I refused to register them. And that was a big step, because a lot of people depend on finances through child tax credits and, you know, social assistance programs and such. That's why a lot of Native people register their kids, and they have been. But yeah, so that was like a big step that made me really have to look at my own independence, because I could not depend on handouts. I could not depend on that, and I had to provide my kids with their own food, you know, decolonize the way that I feed my children, rather than going to the store to go buy, craft dinner and, you know, ramen noodles. Like, I had to, I got to smoke this whole moose, and it's a hard work. I got to dry all of this salmon and can all of the salmon and put enough food away like our ancestors did. So that was like a really big thing, and not having to have to pay rent and to be able to build my own traditional structure so that my children could live in a round building, underground pit house like our ancestors did, and to be able to provide ourselves with as much as we can and not being dependent on, you know, capitalist society for clothes and, you know, all of these things. Really, it's about independence. And it's autonomy. It's like pure autonomy and being able to provide ourselves with looking after our children, just like our ancestors looked after our children and never depended on anybody to do it for us. And so I encourage everybody out there to look at things that we can start doing on ourselves, wild harvest, picking our foods and our greens, rather than going and, you know, you live there, like the nettles are probably out right now. The yarrow is probably out. There's things that people that are way healthier than going to buy some GMO cabbage or something in the store. So there's little things that we can do to become more independent.
So decolonization takes all forms, including decolonizing your food system, decolonizing your way of raising children. If you are interested in seeing more about Ekanahus's struggle in raising decolonized children, that film is at freedombabies2014.com. And you can hear Ekanahus Manuel, the warrior activist that we've just been listening to, next Tuesday, February 24th at Portland State University, along with a whole panel. I didn't even mention Omar Barghouti, a Palestinian intellectual and activist. He will be there. He is the co-founder of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. Ekanahus, who we've just been speaking with. Cecily, who is the Deputy Director of Jewish Voice for Peace, Cecily Saraski, who has been on with us this hour. Dr. Michael Yellowbird, Professor of Sociology and Director of Indigenous Tribal Studies at North Dakota State University. That will be this coming Tuesday, February 24th, 6:30 p.m. at the Smith Ballroom at Portland State University. That's room 355 in the Smith Student Center. And we're going to go out with a piece of music from the band Savage Fam. This is called Face Off.
I got the prayers of my people, now they burning in my strap from the kids who wasn't heard when they was murdered at their hands. We'll sing sacred songs and raise the dead. Back from the ages when our people knew to pray, but mistake them and they'll take his hands. Now we take our own life, but Native, if you won't die, fight for those that feel the same and find us on the front line. I know that sometimes people tell you other words, but they can't tell you nothing when you can with the Thunderbird. This is for all the kids who feel like they don't want to live because our people lost their way and concentrate on politics. Instead of all the causes of the problems that we face, and now we forgive and shit, let's take them down. Without remorse, surround the force and burn to ash. Do not feel scared, we'll offer prayers with every pistol blast. And every kid will laugh and mothers will feel safe. And we'll bless ourselves in the blood and know it wasn't a mistake.
Between the living and the dead, little do you know what happens after thunder grows. I fight for it, know it's right till I'm gone.
Fight for the struggle, fight to end the pain. Fight for the cries of the innocent slain. Fight for my people, give my life to make a change. All the blood that we share, they can never take away.
I see kids dying on the red soap, but that'll blow your face off. This the face off between the living and the dead. But that'll blow your face off. This is a face off between the living and the dead. Little do you know what happens after thunder grows. I'll fight for it. I know it was right till I'm gone. I see kids dying on the red. I'm the red.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 25th Cascade Festival of African Films, happening Thursdays through Sundays, now through March 8th, in celebration of Black History Month at Portland Community College Cascade Campus. The theme this year is Africa Through African Lenses, and features the films Half of a Yellow Sun, Finding Fela, Lessons of Basketball and War, Under the Starry Sky, and many more. That's the 25th Cascade Festival of African Films at PCC Cascade, 705 North Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Becoming Dr. Ruth, produced by Triangle Theater. Starting February 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Becoming Dr. Ruth tells the story of the